Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
Hell of war!
Drug war!
Hell of war!
Drug war!
Hell of war!
Drug war!
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Welcome to this special edition of Cultural Baggage. We're going to take a look back and a listen to the drug war news of the year 2005. We begin by tuning in to our first guest on January 4th, author of Strength of the Wolf, Mr. Doug Valentine.
In 1960, the CIA formed what's called its Division D. And Division D was the unit of the CIA in its counterintelligence, its foreign intelligence branch that went out and captured enemy spies and got their code books and all that kind of stuff. And hidden within that, it was a unit run by a guy named Bill Harvey. And within that unit, there was a secret assassination program, because the CIA is boxes within boxes within boxes, just like American foreign policy is boxes within boxes within boxes. And when it got right down to this assassination program that was hidden in there, the people that Bill Harvey hired to get assassins were agents of the Bureau of Narcotics, and the people that they hired as assassins were Corsican drug smugglers. So what you have is at the very heart of America's espionage establishment, of its secret wars around the world, at the very heart of it you have drug trafficking agents, drug traffickers, CIA agents, all mixed up together in the underworld milieu where people change identities, where they cross borders illegally, where they smuggle things, all sorts of things across borders. This is, and they all do it illegally, and because they do it illegally, they have to have, a cover. This is what the book's about. It's about the relationship between drug smuggling, espionage, and how there's actually secret policies that control where our country is going as opposed to its stated policies.
On February 15th, we had six members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and this is former police officer Earl Barnett.
On the federal, state, and local level, there's a fairly massive amount of money that is being spent to enforce drug laws in this country.
Have the efforts of law enforcement cut down on the number of users or prevented our youth from having access?
In my opinion, no. I have gone back and looked at our reports from several years ago with the sheriff's office and looked at the amount of drugs that were seized, the categories they were seized in, and the value at the time. And here, 10 years later, the only change is that we're seizing more drugs off the street. The value hasn't changed very much, except that the quality of the drugs is getting higher, such as with cocaine and especially heroin.
What might be a better solution than our current tactics?
I think education is the direction that we need to go into. This business of the government punishing individuals because they choose to make a wrong decision for themselves just seems to be non-productive.
Drugs will destroy your life, especially if you're caught, jailed, and permanently stigmatized. Drugs enslave our children, especially if they're made by charlatans and sold by gangsters. Drugs and crime go together like peanut butter and jelly. Everybody likes peanut butter and jelly. Drugs. To learn more, please visit the website of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc. On March 15th, our guest was President of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas, Mr. Carl Vailey.
If you look at the most basic element of the drug war, it's a bit of commerce, like any other commerce. We have a buyer and a seller. And if both the buyer and the seller are happy with their transaction, they're not about to invite anybody else in to break it up. And so if some third party, the government or whoever, decides that they don't want this transaction to take place for whatever reason, they must rely on deceit. That is, they must have some sort of a spy or an informant, or they must be eavesdropping or some form of deceit to get into this transaction where they're not invited. Now, everybody has been taught since they were tiny children that deceit is bad, with the exception of when the deceived party really has it coming. And so, if we are to believe that they really have it coming, we have to believe that those parties being deceived are very bad people. That means demonization. And prohibition is simply not possible without it. So prohibition, which the war on drugs is a form of institutionalized deceit. And when we institutionalize deceit, we introduce all sorts of other things. For example, the easiest targets to demonize are those that we can spot on appearance. And what does that mean? That means instantly we have to demonize based on racism. And the drug war, as you are well aware, is basically racist. It's very strong racist overtones at very best.
Our good friend Cliff Thornton brought forward a point just recently that in the U.S., we now have more than 1 million black people behind bars, more people than there were slaves during the Civil War.
I've met Cliff, and he's a very, very intelligent guy, and he's exactly right on that. It's a very subtle form of demonization, which is really an extension of the same thing. In many ways, I think it's more insidious than the out-and-out segregation, and it's at least as damaging, and partly because of its more hidden qualities or its being less obvious. But when we demonize, of course, this means that we have to do things like approve of violence as well. And I think the increase in violence in our country has gone parallel to the growth in the demonization industry that's otherwise called prohibition.
On April 29th, our guest was head of the biology department at the University of Colorado, Dr. Robert Melamed.
For a drug company to make money on a product that they produce, they've got to typically have some kind of patent on it or something else that'll keep out competitors. All right. Now, the problem with marijuana is that you can't patent the plant. You might be able to patent a particular strain, like one, for example, that has no THC and could be grown for hemp, but you can't patent marijuana plants as a general entity. So a drug company has to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars in bringing any drug to the market. So they typically do that when they own a patent on something that looks promising. And since in this case they can't have a patent on it, that's why marijuana has lingered in the pharmaceutical industry, even though it's been recognized now by researchers around the world as literally regulating all aspects of our lives in terms of our body function. So what the drug companies have done, as a result really of researchers having done it, and then the drug companies buy the patents on it, researchers have discovered a variety of synthetic cannabinoids that mimic THC, as well as essentially therefore mimicking the compounds that our body produces, the endocannabinoids. So there's a variety of different classes of compounds that serve as these mimics, and that are patented. So now the drug company can develop something, and they can own what they develop and essentially produce a pharmaceutical product.
On May 6th, we reported on a conference held in Washington, D.C. by the Marijuana Policy Project, MPP.org. From the press conference, Congressman Dana Rohrabacher.
We need to have a good dose of common sense when it comes to these type of laws. It makes no sense at all to have the federal government overriding a vote of the people of a state on what should be criminalized and what shouldn't be criminalized in terms of personal consumption. Our founding fathers set up a federal system for a purpose, was to protect the rights of the individual, and it was to have a system that would be more responsive to the people and be actually a more efficient way of administering law. It was very clear our founding fathers wanted criminal law to be handled at the state and local level. The federal government should not be interfering in this, especially when it deals with a direct vote of the people as to something that they want to have legal or illegal in terms of personal consumption. In this case, what we've got is the medical use of marijuana. I see no reason to believe that the people of the various states cannot make up their mind as to whether doctors should be permitted to offer prescriptions of marijuana for their patients if they believe that this is better for their patients. The federal government should butt out.
America sleeps well knowing that the drug war protects their children from drugs. Yet children have easier access to drugs than alcohol or tobacco. Politicians work hard, spending ever more money to crush the black market. And yet, each year we give $500 billion to terrorists, cartels, and criminals to buy bigger weapons to kill us. The drug czar tries to ensure that fewer people die from using hard drugs, yet each year aspirin kills more people than do all hard drugs combined. The unvarnished truth is at drugtruth.net. On June 24th, we invited as our guest Norm Stamper, the former police chief of Seattle and author of the great new book, Breaking Rank.
I think we all know, you know, money has that seductive effect on the, you know, the character challenged in every occupation. And in fact, it's a global phenomenon where there are large sums of illicit money predicated on an unlawful demand for a commodity. You're going to have temptation, and for those who lack the character or simply lack a spine, the temptation can be too great, and we wind up, as I've also cited in my book in a couple of chapters, just a depressing string of corrupt acts by police officers who did the wrong thing when they should have done the right thing.
There is what some folks call the blue, the if you will, a mask or a means to hide what cops do sometimes. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I refer to that as the blue wall of silence, and have a chapter of Breaking Rank dedicated to precisely that issue. Police officers, as I mentioned earlier, do in fact perform a dangerous job. One reality that arises from that truth is that when you need your backup, you need your backup. And so there is this mentality that develops that if I, as an honest and honorable police officer, snitch you off for having done something wrong or not done something right, then the next time around you may not cover me. And so that's one sort of condition of the culture that gives rise to this so-called blue wall of silence. But there's also this sort of in-group solidarity that I understand in light of those cultural pressures, but simply cannot possibly condone.
On July 29th, our guest was Dr. Frank Fisher, a man brought to the brink of a trial for murder following the death of a OxyContin user who died as the passenger in a fatal car accident.
Pain is a deadly disease. When you stub your toe, you get over it pretty quickly. But if that pain didn't go away, there might not be anything but opioids that would control it and allow you to have a normal life. So opioids are the cornerstone of the management of chronic pain. In most severe cases, there aren't any other good alternatives. With OxyContin, which is a product that sells over $1 billion a year, there are no recorded deaths from patients taking it as prescribed. And when other people get hold of it and abuse it, in 97% of the cases, when death results, there's other stuff on board, usually alcohol. So even in willful abusers, a pure OxyContin death is the rarest sort of circumstance. What that tells you is while these things are dangerous to be abused, apparently the dangers are way overstated. Not that I'm advocating any kind of an abuse, but then they tell us we've got this epidemic of controlled substances abuse, and that's incredibly hypocritical in a situation where we have 100,000 people a year dying from alcohol-related car crashes and 500,000 people dying a year from tobacco abuse. And what we have is this incredible imbalance where the DEA is out protecting willful substance abusers from the consequences of our own actions just by scaring the wits out of the medical profession to try to limit the availability of this stuff. And it doesn't make any sense when you look at it that way. It's the ultimate hypocrisy. What you have is effectively a government agency out of control conducting a holy war and imposing their ideas about what is essentially morality, just like the Taliban.
We have two segments from August I want to bring you. First, from August 19th, the spokesperson for the Journey for Justice March on Washington, D.C., Ms. Roberta Franklin.
And I'm more concerned that we, as family members of people incarcerated, activists, organizations, and people that have struggled so hard to get here today. And what's so wonderful about this group of people today, everybody got here on their own dime. Everybody got here by denying something or doing like me, putting the light bill money up and maybe not have lights when we go home. But we all got here because we know that in this country today, our criminal justice system is a joke. When we really think about it, the security around here is so sad that we have become prisoners in our own country because of the injustices we as a nation have done to other people. We don't even have to look to other countries. We just have to look to America's prison. President Bush was so shocked at Abu Ghraib. He says, this is not the American way.
What?
He's a liar.
That's right.
And I hope he hears us today. He is a liar. Not only is it the American way, it's the only way America knows. It's all they know.
That's right.
Some of the worst abuses in this country occurred under George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas. People were tased. Dogs were put on them. This was in prison. We got them. We got video. We got pictures. So he is a liar.
Roberta Franklin, a fellow radio talk show host out of Montgomery, Alabama, was recently convicted of not checking a box on a food stamp application. The state attorney took time out of his schedule to try her himself. He wants to send her to prison for up to 20 years. On August 26, we reported from the Methamphetamine, HIV, and Hep C conference in Salt Lake City. This is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org, Mr. Ethan Nadelman.
Well, you know, it's hard to know a lot about methamphetamine if what you'll have to rely on is the media or occasional people you know who use the stuff. And what's been so remarkable about this conference has really been a couple of things. The first one has been the sort of coming together in the same room where about a third or so of the audience is coming out of the harm reduction world. And maybe a third to a half. And then the other half is really coming out of a much more conventional approach. People concerned about methamphetamine and about AIDS, hepatitis, and looking for some new approaches, looking for answers, looking for, you know, new questions to be asked. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is just that there's panels and presentations here which are just eye-opening. I find that I have probably learned more in the, you know, 36 hours at this conference or what have you than I have learned in any 36-hour period in a long time. So this really has been a role model for how a conference can accomplish a lot of good.
You know, I'm a legalizer just outright, and I feel that change comes about incrementally, and certainly the truth brought forward at this conference will be of benefit to many people as the attendees disseminate this information across the nation.
Well, no, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the Congressman Souter, who launched that really hostile attack on this conference and basically revealed his true colors, which is to foreclose any really open discussion, to keep thinking as much as possible constrained within the box. But, you know, he's putting out this notion that harm reduction is all a Trojan horse for legalization. And I think what he fails to realize, first of all, is that the vast majority of people who support harm reduction are not comfortable embracing full legalization. But that secondly, for many people like myself, who regard harm reduction as the fundamental approach we have to bring to bear on dealing with drug problems, that the question is, when you look at drug problems from a harm reduction approach, how does legalization fit into that? You know, we've come to the conclusion that legalization of marijuana is the ultimate harm reduction approach with respect to marijuana. With other drugs, it's a lot less clear. So I think, you know, what you have here is people beginning to really open up their horizons about how to deal with this stuff.
On September 16th, I took a rare opportunity to share with my listeners a more in-depth, more comprehensive look at my stance taken in the drug war. This is part of a speech I gave to the American Constitution Society, and I'm talking about who benefits from the drug war.
Cops, doctors, scientists, and experts, those in ancillary positions of authority, the working man of the drug war, they make sure their mortgage payments are met and their retirement assured by joining in the feast of the drug war. Their meat is spewing tales of dread and woe, knowing full well their lives will pay the bills, and the agony that spirals forth from their intervention will be disguised to support their contentions regarding the harms of drugs. There is not one drug warrior in government, corporate, planning, out walking the beat, or testifying in court who deserves a moment's grace. They are all aware, full knowing, and guilty as hell. It is our duty to drive these gross and evil sinners down to the river of reform for baptism. It is our job to sing hallelujah to the end of drug war, to preach, reach, teach, and if necessary, to impeach these sons of Satan. For too long, their attitude, the drug warriors, with their out-of-control policy, in and of itself, have barred the discussion which will force us to repeal these unconstitutional laws. Drugs enslave people has been the mantra over the decades of drug war. Never mind that our policy has destroyed the lives of tens of millions of individuals and their family structures. Pay no attention to the news that tobacco kills more than 400,000 U.S. citizens each year, that alcohol kills more than 100,000 annually, and that doctors and pharmacists screw up to the tune of 120,000 needless deaths each year in writing and filling prescriptions. Black market drugs made by untrained chemists, distributed by armed gangsters, and diluted with everything from laxatives to Drano kill less than 3,000 users per year. After 8,000 years of recorded history, the death toll from cannabis remains at zero. Despite our best efforts, aspirin and Tylenol still kill more people each year than all the products made by unprofessional black market chemists. And most of the deaths attributed to drug war result from the violence of prohibition, not the use of the drugs themselves.
On October 28th, I reported on a conference held in Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by Aetna Insurance, put together by Trinity College and attended by leaders in law enforcement and the health community. Now let us hear from Marilda Garanda, president of Aetna Foundation.
One thing that I want to talk about, as you set out to look at, as the mayor said, what we call at Aetna the low-hanging fruit, sort of the quick fixes, but also the back burner issues and the issues that sometimes we don't, in our daily life, don't get to talk about because we're just so concerned. Whether you're a police officer, a social worker, whatever you are doing and you're in the trenches on the drug war, you have so much to do today that it's really hard to think about the root causes. Since I was in college, I have suffered from a deep chronic depression. That may come as a surprise to some of you who know me well, because my natural personality is sort of the opposite of that. But the reason I raise that is because when you scratch the surface, but just a little bit, in terms of drug use, you find mental health issues very quickly. We know, for example, that something like 75% of alcoholics are chronically depressed. And the issue of self-medication is an important one, and it is something that cannot be overlooked. In a conference like this, we need to think about containing the problem that we have and resolving it, but I think it's very hard to do that if we do not address what is the foundational issue for a lot of the people who are addicted to whatever the substance is. I always consider myself to be just so lucky and blessed because I have had a family who, they've been there with me, they've taken care of me. I've had health insurance, I've had access to good counselors and good psychiatrists. I have access to medication, and I have insurance to pay for it, and we're fortunate that we live in the country where all of that is happening. And I also consider myself very blessed because I'm living now in an era where the stigma of standing up here and saying, you know, I have had a chronic depression and a deep issue since I was in college, and everything I have achieved in my life, my law degree, my career at Aetna, my wonderful son who is 30 years old, I've done all of that with that kind of an illness. But an awful lot of that has been because of the support systems that I have had. There are a lot of young people, particularly in our urban areas, who have the stressors and the triggers to become mentally ill very early, and unfortunately, we really don't have, in this great country of ours, the allocation of resources to this very serious problem.
On November 18th, we reported from the Drug Policy Alliance Conference out in Long Beach, California. Up in Denver, a new organization, SAFER, pushed forward a resolution that the voters of Denver passed to allow adults to legally possess up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
I'm here with Mr. Mason Tevert, the executive director of Safer Alternatives for Enjoyable Recreation. Tell us about the initiative and the results and what it means.
What we did was we have amended the Denver City Ordinance to wipe out all civil and criminal penalties for possession of less than an ounce of marijuana for adults over 21 years old. And this is the first city in the country to do so, to remove all penalties. And what our message has been is that it really makes absolutely no sense to prohibit adults from making the rational, safer decision to use marijuana instead of alcohol. And currently we have laws that foster this so-called culture of alcohol and push adults towards using a drug that's more harmful than they might otherwise choose to use. And it's really what it comes down to is it's not good public policy. It needs to be changed, and people are fed up with it. And the people of Denver spoke very loud and clear about that at this recent election. 53%, even a little more, 53.5%, voted to remove these penalties because they are fed up with a system that does not allow them to make a safer decision on behalf of what they put in their own body.
On December 2nd, we had Dr. Rick Doblin, president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS.org.
In the 50s, the culture was really, if you talked about yoga, if you talked about meditation, you were considered a nut. You know, I mean, everybody talks about yoga and meditation now, you know, mindfulness, relaxation. You know, back then, if my dad, this is the best example, I was born in 1953. My father is a pediatrician, and they did not let the fathers, even doctors, into the delivery room. And there was just, similarly, death, you didn't talk about it. So we've done a lot in our culture in the last 50 years to integrate birth, integrate death, integrate meditation and yoga and all these other things. Don't seem so weird. And so now I think we're ready for not just when psychedelics goes wrong, but what do we do when psychedelics go right?
Well, I hope you enjoyed this look back at the year 2005 and that you'll join us next week on Cultural Baggage. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss.